I'm Steve Kraske of the Kansas City Star, and this is Up to Date. Visit a small town ripe for fracking exploitation and zip down Central Park West with FDR. Feel the pain of a gay couple in the 1970s as they fight to care for an abandoned, mentally ill teenager. Our indie, foreign, and documentary film critics list includes all of these and much more as they take a look at the film's opening on the silver screen in Kansas City this week. And as long as we're on the subject of opinions, we'll get theirs on yesterday's Oscar nominees. Movies worth watching on Up to Date after this hour's news. Welcome to Up to Date. I'm Steve Kraske. Well, I had this theory about the films of 2012. There were some good ones, to be sure, but what 2012 lacked was the consensus selection of a must-see film, unlike some films from yesteryear, like Schindler's List or Forrest Gump or Gandhi or the first two Godfather films or even The Sound of Music, all won Best Picture awards. Today we'll find out if our film critics agree with my theory as we run down the Oscar nominations and the latest independent foreign and documentary films now showing. Our critics today, Bob Butler is a former film critic for The Star who writes about new films at butlerscinemascene.com and programs films and much more for the Kansas City, Missouri Public Library. Bob, nice to have you.
Good morning.
Good morning. And Cynthia Haynes joins us on the line this morning from Los Angeles, where the lucky lady attended the Critics' Choice Awards. Cynthia, thanks so much for taking a few minutes with us, and good to have you from L.A. here.
Thank you so much. I understand there are two seats in the studio today.
Yes, there are, and our wishes go out for a quick recovery to our other critic, Steve Walker, who has come down with the flu. Well, as I said, the Oscar nominations came out yesterday. Lincoln is sweeping up many of the early nominations. The Critics' Choice Awards are out. And yet I still say that 2012 lacked a single film that almost everyone agrees was a terrific picture. Bob, what do you say to that?
Well, I'm a classic case of the dissenter in this. I thought Daniel Day-Lewis gave one of the greatest performances I've ever seen as Abraham Lincoln, but I found the movie surrounding him to be very talky, kind of a creaky history lesson.
That's what I'm talking about. Every film that people seem to really talk about and get some buzz, but there's something wrong with it.
Well, look what happened to Zero Dark Thirty, which just opened, the Bin Laden movie. It's been weathering criticism that it encourages or approves of torture. So it almost sounds a little bit like, you may be too young for this, but the Fuhrer over the Deer Hunter way back in the day.
Even Life of Pi, my neighbors recommended it. It was good, but I didn't think it was sensational. Cynthia, weigh in on all this.
Well, I agree, and I think the winners yesterday or last night of the Critics' Choice Awards indicate something that's going on here. I think the Academy is going to be leaning toward Lincoln. The median age of the Academy is, I think, 58 or 60, somewhere up there. Catherine Bigelow was shut out. Ben Affleck was shut out of Oscar nominations. And I think they're saying something to the filmmaking community, because last night for Best Picture, Ben Affleck won for his film Argo, and he won for Best Director. And you've got 270 members who are professional film critics who literally see everything. And so they put their money on Argo and not on Lincoln, which everyone thought was going to sweep every award.
Were you surprised by that, Cynthia, that Argo won the Critics' Choice?
To some extent I was, but I think a lot was indicated by the level of applause when various filmmakers and actors and actresses were introduced, and he seems to be a favorite among those in Hollywood, and he sure worked hard in selling his film. But again, there's also been criticism, and those are two films that both deal with American foreign policy, and they're not documentaries, Bob. I mean, that's something people tend to forget. Do you agree?
Yeah, I do. It's interesting because a lot of the movies that people talk about, but I'm not sure they love, tend to be about policy. They tend to be about big moral issues, not just on an individual level, but on a national level. And that's something that's really hard for this fractured society of ours to get their heads around.
How surprised were you that Argo won Critics' Choice last night, Bob?
Not really. I'll tell you, well, here's the thing about Argo. Argo is a great real-life thriller. Of course, it's about the escape of the American hostages after the Iran Revolution. But it's one of those movies that what you see is all you get. It is not a movie with a lot of subtext. It's not a movie with a lot of, you know, things that will keep you coming back to it.
Grandeur,
for years and finding new meanings. I mean, all the meaning there, and it's fine for what it is right there on the screen. I don't think there's a whole lot to pick over afterwards.
Yeah, I agree with you, Bob. I did watch it twice, and it really does hold up second time around, even though you very well know, you know, how it ends. I think it was so well edited. I mean, there's an example of how editing can really make a film, and I think that's the case with this movie. And also the cinematography created a level of tension and excitement. And, it, you know, you could look at it as a basic good old Hollywood movie with manufactured scenes that were incorporated into this true life story.
You know, there is something to be said, Cynthia, for what your point a few minutes ago, this notion that the Academy, when it comes to the Oscars, does like films that sort of, I'm using the word grandeur again, sort of have that sort of element attached to them. And certainly Lincoln has some of that going forward. Is that your sense, too?
I think so. And if you look at these other films, so many of them that have been nominated are, once again, the kinds of films we talk about on this show, the foreign art and independent films. Amour, that was a big surprise, got nominations, the Oscar nominations. And it actually won the Best Foreign Language Film at the Critics' Choice Awards. So, you know, it's just there, as you said at the beginning of the show, there just wasn't a lot of variety and a lot of films that were our must-see.
I'm kind of having to chuckle a bit because you may recall a couple years ago when the Oscar people said, well, we're going to allow up to 10 Best Picture nominees. The rationale was, well, we can stick some really popular things in, you know, some comic book movies, something, you know, to give give the vast majority
get the
of
young
film goers.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And what happens? Does the latest Batman movie get even one nomination? No, completely.
And it should have.
Or James Bond.
James Bond, I think, got one for in the tech category. But even so, so if you're hoping to appeal to the fanboys, the Oscars are still as irrelevant as ever to those guys.
So I guess
I'm sorry, go ahead.
Well, I guess the question I have, Cynthia, is this idea, is this batch of films this year, again, many of them rank as Bs instead of As, are we missing A-grade films this year, or is it getting to Bob Butler's point that our fractured society these days, people are going in so many different directions, have so many varied interests, that it's hard to build consensus behind one film anymore?
I think that's a very good point. I really do. I think there are other issues that the filmmakers are dealing with, too, is figuring out how their movies are going to be seen. And I read an article where the cinematographers are altering the composition and design of the images that they're putting up there on the screen because people are watching them on their computers, iPads, and their cell phones. They're not watching them on the big screens anymore. So, and younger people are more apt to do that. They're more willing to do that than...
Well, I'm just wondering if our listeners have opinions on what they think was the best film of 2012 based. You can go online and look at what the Oscar nominees are. You can go and see what the Critics' Choice came out with. What was your best picture of 2012? Our phone number here, 816-235-2888. Our email address, update@kcur.org, or go to KCUR's Facebook page. You know, one film that seems to be sort of sneaking up on people a little bit, Bob Butler, is Silver Linings Playbook, more nominations, I think, than perhaps some people expected.
Yeah, I came in second behind Lincoln.
Remind us what that film's about and why is it doing as well as it's doing?
Well, it's a love story. That always plays, but it's a curious love story. It's a love story about, how should we call it, damaged people. Bradley Cooper, who, of course, is very hot right now, plays a guy who has spent some time in a mental institution after melting down when his wife left him. He's finally come back to hearth and home. His parents both nominees. Incidentally, this movie is the only movie in something like 30 years to get a candidate in all four acting categories. Pretty amazing.
That's interesting.
He comes back
which is strange, because I think it's a very uneven film. It's got a pat ending. I was disappointed by it. I really was.
And Cynthia, I agree with you, by the way. Yeah.
I think it's a good movie. I don't think it's a great movie. I enjoyed it, but it didn't blow me away. But, you know, it's a love story about a guy who's trying to put his life back together, and that has a kind of populist appeal right there. Also, the fact that you've got two incredibly sexy stars, that doesn't hurt.
I have to tell you, the director of the film got up last night at the Critics' Choice Awards and said that he made this film for his son. And you know, he mentioned several times his son has emotional issues, and he really felt that this is a film that might sensitize people to issues that other people have. So he made a point of that. Bob, I want to tell you, I did have a chance to talk with Daniel Day-Lewis, and I think I asked you as I was leaving our last show if you wanted me to ask him anything. And I think the question, what I remember, is that you wanted to know if, in fact, he took anything to his own life from the experience of having played Lincoln in the film?
Yeah, well, he's a guy who allegedly stays in character 24/7 while he's making a movie.
Yeah.
Right. Well, first of all, I have to tell you, he is the most charming, unassuming, gentle man you could ever imagine. And I asked him that very question, and he smiled, and he said, he hesitated, and he said, it's a little too soon to answer that question, but I certainly hope I did.
Boy, that's a nice one. Well, it's not for nothing his father was Poet Laureate of Great Britain.
Well, so, Cynthia, let's just slow this show down for a moment and just for a moment indulge us. Who else did you happen to rub elbows with last night at the Critics' Choice Awards?
Well, let's see. Bob De Niro. Oh, excuse me. Robert De Niro.
name dropper.
Jessica Chastain was gorgeous and most charming.
From Zero Dark Thirty.
Zero Dark Thirty. Tommy Lee Jones, believe it or not. I was a little reluctant to go up and talk to him. And he was absolutely delightful.
Why were you reluctant to go up and talk to him?
Bob, you want to answer that question?
He does not suffer fools, or even close to fools, lightly. He's been known to pretty much tell you, that's the stupidest question I've ever heard get out of my life.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow.
So anyway, I was very happy that he was willing to visit. Anne Hathaway, Jack Black, who was absolutely fantastic, Sally Field, Amy Adams, Ben Affleck, who was sitting with George Clooney. And wonderful conversation with John Hawkes. The reason I bring him up is that he was in Lawrence and made a film, part of the film was shot in Lawrence, about Stan Hurd, the film Works. Do you remember that, Bob?
Right.
Great. Earthworks was the name of the movie. Great movie.
Earthworks. And he was in Winter's Bone and was nominated for Sessions. So he is just, again, I think the ones who really do well in Hollywood are pretty genuine people. I mean, if you're flaky, I don't think you survive in that climate.
So, now, we're looking for our listeners to chime in with their picks for the best film of 2012. Again, our number, 816-235-2888. Do you think Lincoln deserves the best Oscar for Best Picture, the Oscar for Best Picture? Our email address, again, updatedate@kcur.org, or go to KCUR's Facebook page. You know, my nomination for Best Film of 2012, The Sessions, with the film, the actor that
Cynthia... So you
Cynthia
took my word just, and saw that, did
I
you?
I did. I just thought... And Cynthia, you made a great point about that film, which is about a man who's confined to an iron lung who wants to experience real love at least once in his life. And it's a remarkable film because, for several reasons, but one reason is because, as Cynthia Haynes pointed out on this show, that film could have gone off rail 15 times during the course of those 2 hours and succeeded in not doing that. To me, it's proved to be touching, highly emotional, and just I was just riveted by it, and just a terrific film.
One of the comments John Hawkes made, though, was how physically difficult it was day after day because he was contorted in that with pillows and various props that kept his body strange angles, and he said, you know, they'd have to spend the whole day filming like that, and he said once he got up at the end of the day, it was often, you know, very difficult for him to, you know, regain his balance and his physical strength. So, you know, he went through quite a bit to create that performance, which I thought was really quite good.
That's interesting.
Well, I agree with you. The Sessions is a great movie. The one that I dearly love this year and almost got shut out, it got a screenplay nomination, was Moonrise Kingdom, which I found to be one of the most fantastic little fables ever made. And maybe it was too delicate for Hollywood, or maybe it came too early in the year, because Hollywood does have a short attention span.
Some nominations
agree with you.
Some nominations are rolling in here for Best Film of 2012. Nancy emails us at updatedatkcur.org. Hands down, she writes, I loved Beast of the Southern Wild. I thought it was unique, beautifully filmed, and just I just loved it. That film is sitting on my desk at home from Netflix. Bob Butler, what was Beast of the Southern Wild about?
About a little girl. It's actually a fairy tale in a way, set in the real world. It's about a little girl with her father. She's growing up in the bayous of Louisiana when a hurricane hits. I'm going to try to pronounce this little girl's name. Her last name is Wallace. I can handle that. Kivanchene, something like that. Anyway, only seven when she made the movie. Youngest person ever nominated for an Oscar. They talk about old souls and young bodies. This is a case of that. This girl is unbelievable. The film was a little bit surreal, kind of dreamlike, but achingly beautiful.
Bob, she was at the Critics' Choice Awards last night and was a real hoot. There was music playing. There was an after party, and she was dancing all over the place. And everybody calls her Q because no one can correctly pronounce her name. So she was there, did a lot of press in Los Angeles, and is an absolute charmer. And actually, I think, Bob, and I may be wrong, but I think she was 5 years old when she made
I heard she was five when she was cast, and it took a while to get the movie made, but whatever.
Yeah.
I mean, anybody under age of 10 who could pull off a performance like that gets my hat tipped.
Again,
I agree with you.
We're looking for your nominees for Best Picture. Is Lincoln destined to be Best Picture at the Oscars in a few weeks? Gabby in Kansas City, Missouri writes us this. Without a doubt, Lincoln. I just can't agree with Steve on this one. I think it has all the components of a blockbuster. Daniel Day-Lewis was Lincoln. Sally Field was amazing. And the cinematography was outstanding. I loved Les Mis, but it was outdone by Lincoln.
Boy, that's a toughie. I'll tell you what, I got more of an emotional buzz, and this maybe it's the old, the old high school drama geek coming out of me here. Some of the moments in Les Mis, the musical moments, absolutely floored me. I've rarely seen a musical where lyric, vocal, music came together and knocked me over like that. I say that knowing that this was a musical based on a book that was serialized, so it was padded, and the movie feels padded to me. There are times when I kept looking at my watch, but when it clicks, great stuff.
816. Go ahead, Cynthia.
Oh, I was going to say, I went up to Anne Hathaway, and I said, Anne, you created for me one of the most incredible 4.5 minutes I've ever seen on film, and it's that where she sings,
sure, her solo.
I Dream a Dream. That her solo, which was one take, and she said the director didn't tell her that he was just going to use that one take, that he used several cameras just in case they had to redo it. And she said she didn't know until the final edit that they were actually going to use that one continuous shot. And it is very profound, very emotional. I wish there were more of Anne Hathaway in the film.
Yeah.
And so I was disappointed in that, and I was generally disappointed in the film itself.
I've heard that from others as well. Again, your nominations for Best Picture of 2012, 816-235-2888, our email address, updatedatkcur.org. Jeff Chitty tweets us this, I know it won't win, but I thought Django Unchained was the best film I saw all year. He writes, though, he's looking forward to seeing War, though. And when is that film coming here?
It's going to be opening here in about 3 weeks, I believe.
And this is a love story between two very
About a husband and wife living in Paris. They are in their 70s, maybe even their 80s. And she has a stroke or some sort of cerebral incident. And it's about her fading away, him doing everything he can to take care of her, and finally admitting that he can't.
And you like that film?
It's heartbreaking. The acting is unbelievable. It's very claustrophobic, mostly takes place in one apartment. It was made by a German director named Michael Haneke, who's known for his incredibly violent movies. And this movie isn't physically violent, but emotionally, I guess you could say it is.
Cynthia, what did you think?
Haneke was at the Critics' Choice Awards last night, and he thanked the organization for the nomination and the award, and he said it wasn't until the American critics interpreted the film or critiqued it that anyone really got it. He just felt like his European colleagues didn't. The thing is, I think they were shocked that he made such a gentle, well, I say gentle, and I should be careful about using that word in describing the film, because it's very dark and profound at moments, but that he was the filmmaker who made this particular movie. You could not tell it from watching it relative to the other films that he's made. So, anyway.
If you have a nomination for Best Picture of 2012, 816-235-2888. Let's go to Tom from Lee's Summit. Tom, good morning.
Yes. Django Unchained was, I think, absolutely the best.
Because
movie.
Why, Tom?
The most exciting, just riveting from beginning to end. Great performances. It was wonderful. I was actually calling because of the clownish performance of Tommy Lee Jones in Lincoln, which absolutely spoiled the movie. I thought the movie was dull and a mess anyway.
Hmm. All right, Tom. Thank you for your phone call. I appreciate it. Mm-hmm. Burdette Loomis, one of our political pundits, writes us this. Searching for Sugar Man is his pick for Best Film of 2012. It's a great documentary. I guess it was nominated in
the documentary
category, too. So, okay.
And guess what? Rodriguez was there last night.
The musician, the lost musician, yes. Who is the star of that movie.
The lost musician. I'm sorry, go ahead.
Who has been found all of a sudden, yeah.
He has been found. He was at the show. Unfortunately, he didn't get to get up on stage. It was running late, and they just announced some of the winners during the commercial breaks, unfortunately. The other person I could, from the documentary world, I met the Queen of Versailles.
Oh.
I don't know if we ought to put the pictures up on the website, but anyway, she was there last too.
That's a story of a very wealthy couple who suddenly has to go through some very tough financial times, right?
That's right. And apparently they're talking sequel. Go figure.
Well, in the wake of all these nominations and in the wake of all this chatter about the best films of 2012, I'm wondering, Bob Butler, what was your top pick for 2012? You got
one?
Wow,
toughie. Well, you know, you're right. Almost everything had some sort of major flaw in it. But, like I said, Moonrise Kingdom. That's a movie I could probably watch once a month for a long, long time.
Hmm.
I think it would be Southern Wild because it was so original, it was so entertaining, it was so uplifting, and extraordinary performances all across the board, beautifully edited and shot. So that would be my pick.
Greg from Kansas City, Kansas writes us this: I did not see enough films last year to really evaluate which one was best. However, he writes, Lincoln is the only movie I would force all junior high students and all foreign nationals who aspire to citizenship to see, maybe even see it multiple times. I think a great historical movie captures, then translates the spirit and facts of the time and the principal players. Lincoln, he writes, is a great movie.
Let me put on my librarian cap here for a minute.
Yes.
February 12th at the Downtown Library. The author of a new book on William Seward, who was, of course, Lincoln's Secretary of State, played by David Strathairn in the movie. He's going to be talking about it. The program is called Lincoln's Indispensable Man, February 12th. I think it's going to be fantastic.
Okay, and Zach writes us this: Django Unchained was surprisingly brilliant, by far Tarantino's best film, yes, even better than Pulp Fiction, and should get recognition for it. I was, however, very disappointed by The Master. The acting was fantastic, but the plot just never amounted to much of anything.
Well, there wasn't a plot, I think. I think it was just a character study, and that was it. And I think you got to see some virtuoso performances from Philip Seymour Hoffman and
Joaquin
Phoenix that are unforgettable once you do see them.
Yeah, that's it. I kind of felt the same way. Brilliant performances, for the movie overall.
Okay, let's go back to some phone calls here. Keeve from Lawrence. Keeve, what's your pick for Best Film of 2012?
Well, I think Argo is going to win Best Picture. Daniel Day-Lewis will win Best Actor. But my favorite movie of the year was Moonrise Kingdom. It was the funnest, cutest movie I saw all year. And from one of your guests said it was his favorite, and it sounded like maybe Steve hadn't even seen it yet.
I've seen it.
Okay.
Yeah.
You just kind of said,
It would make my list of my favorites, but I liked it. I liked it, but I wasn't blown away by it.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I kind of felt that, yeah, all the movies this year, like, I thought there were so many good movies to go see at the theater this year, but there wasn't one that stood out, and I agree with you all on that.
Yeah, I appreciate that. Keith, thank you for calling. Have a good day. Let's go to Dave from Overland Park. Dave, you're on Up to Date. Good morning.
Hi, good morning. I'm calling not about a movie so much as I am about a performance, and it's Jennifer Lawrence's performance in Silverman's Playbook.
And Dave, I couldn't agree with you more. Go ahead.
I agree with you about the story. You know, it wasn't all that of compelling a story, but it was a complex role that she took on, and she owned it. She did that better than anybody since De Niro in Taxi Driver. I just can't have good things about Jennifer Lawrence.
And she's getting a lot of good buzz, Cynthia Haynes, because of that performance. I've been reading about her for weeks now.
Yeah. I mean, she is just on the superstar trajectory right now. I mean, there couldn't be an actress who's hotter. And don't forget her in Winter's Bone. I mean, that's pre-glam, pre-makeup, pre-Hollywood styling. And she showed incredible talent in that film. And I think we all knew that she was going to go far.
Do you know where she's headed next in terms of a film, Cynthia?
The Hunger Games series she's working on. And I think every director in Hollywood who wants to make money is vying to, cast her in their film.
Okay. You know, what I love about her is that she doesn't take herself seriously. Someone, congratulated her on her important work, and she says, no, brain surgery is important work.
Yeah, right.
That's
all right.
True.
Well, Cynthia Haynes, I want to thank you for taking some time with us today all the way out
from
La La Land out there. You were just great to do it. Have a good time out there, okay?
I have to get ready for my surf lesson here.
Yeah.
So,
I want photos.
Yes, me too.
All right. Thanks so much.
Have a good
really
time, Cynthia.
It.
You bet. Bye-bye.
Thank you.
Well, it's time for a break. When we come back, we'll continue our conversation here with Bob Butler. We'll look at the newest art, independent, and foreign films just out. We'll get a review from Bob on Zero Dark Thirty, the story of the Navy SEAL raid that resulted in the killing of Bin Laden. We'll also talk about Hyde Park on Hudson, the film about FDR starring none other than Bill Murray. I'm Steve Kraske of the Kansas City Star, and you're listening to Up to Date on KCUR. And we're back. I'm Steve Kraske. If you missed yesterday's conversation about the American way of eating, you can find it in our weekend to-do list at kcur.org. On Monday's program, we'll look at the booming oil and gas industry in Kansas. And just a quick note, you can see lots of pictures later on this afternoon of Cynthia Haynes at the Critics' Choice Award once again, with her arms draped around one celebrity after another out in Los Angeles last night. And it's become an annual tradition here on Up to Date to see Cynthia's pictures coming back from Los Angeles. Well, I'm still joined here in the studio by Bob Butler, the former film critic for The Star, now appearing on KCTV with some regularity. Let's run through some films that are just opening, Bob, and one that has lots of people talking, Zero Dark Thirty, the story of the Navy SEAL raid that resulted in the killing of Osama bin Laden.
Well, this is from Catherine Bigelow, who a couple of years ago cleaned up quite nicely with The Hurt Locker.
But wasn't even nominated for this film this time
around.
Right,
although it is up for Best Picture. The film, I think, is a terrific suspense piece that spans an entire decade. I don't know if you remember the film a few years ago, Zodiac, about the Zodiac killers and how the Zodiac killer in California and how a reporter became so obsessed with the case that he literally ruined his life.
Mm-hmm.
There's something like that going on here. It's about a CIA analyst played by Jessica Chastain, based on a real person, although her name's been changed, who over a course of 10 years took one little piece of information about a possible courier who might be dealing with bin Laden and followed it like a bulldog. Once she bit down on it, she would not let go. We've got a film clip, or a clip here that's really kind of wonderful. She plays Maya, who in this scene has been told by her supervisor, played by Kyle Chandler, late of Friday Night Lights, that he doesn't want her chasing bin Laden anymore, that it's a dead end, that there are other things she should be concentrating on.
This is from Zero Dark Thirty.
Someone just tried to blow up Times Square, and you're talking about some facilitator, some detainee 7 years ago said might have been working with Al-Qaeda?
He's the key to bin Laden.
I don't care about bin Laden. You're going to start working on the American Al-Qaeda cells. Protect the homeland.
Bin Laden is the one who keeps telling them to attack the homeland. If it wasn't for him, Al-Qaeda would still be focused on overseas targets. If you really want to protect the homeland, you need to get bin Laden.
This guy never met bin Laden.
You just want me to nail some low-level mullah crackadullah so you can check that box on your resume that says while you were in Pakistan, you got a real terrorist. But the truth is, you don't understand Pakistan, and you don't know Al-Qaeda. Either give me the team I need to follow this lead, or the other thing you're going to have on your resume is being the first station chief to be called before a congressional committee for subverting the efforts to capture or kill bin Laden.
Wow. Yes, wow. Exactly.
That's Jessica Chastain.
Yeah. Now, this film has got sweep. It's got scope. It's also got no small amount of controversy. The first half hour of this film is a brutal interrogation of an Al-Qaeda suspect in the days right after 9/11. In which there's torture, there's waterboarding. I mean, it's just hideous. In fact, the analyst played by Jessica Chastain observes this, and she can almost not stand it. The film does something very interesting. It, at the same time, she learns to handle it, the audience is learning to handle it, and it poses, I think, a profound moral question. Were the results of the torture worth it? Now, the movie has been nailed by a lot of people saying, well, no information obtained through torture got bin Laden. Personally, I find that kind of hard to believe, that, mm-hmm. that no information that led to bin Laden was obtained through any of these enhanced interrogation sessions.
Yeah.
But the movie forces you, as an American citizen who sees these things being done on his or her behalf, to say, is it worth it? Do I condone this? Even if, you know, if that piece of information led to bin Laden's killing, was it a good thing? Was it a bad thing? And any movie that can pose those sorts of questions, I think a lot of people are simplifying it. Oh, it's applauding. Yeah. This is a movie that's all for torture. I don't see that.
Well, and that debate continues even to this day. It began during the Bush administration. It's still ongoing today. You know, Bob, listening to that clip, the question that always comes into my mind when I see a film based on real events like Zero Dark Thirty is, how much of all of this is true? Did that, you know, confrontation really happen? Is it just Hollywood? You just wonder, what am I watching here?
Well, you know,
I'm a journalist at heart, so I, of course, I'm going to ask that question.
You know what? A good movie is better than the truth. And this movie worked for me. It sucked me in, kept me interested for almost 3 hours. The last 45 minutes is almost the real-time mission with a bunch of Navy SEALs going into Pakistan illegally and hitting this compound. It's shot mostly through the green night goggle vision, you know, glasses. It's just stupendous. And, if you know, it's one of these things where you come out and say, well, if it didn't happen that way, it should have.
So you think for sure this film deserved to be nominated for an Oscar for Best Picture?
I do. I definitely do, yeah.
Yeah.
And you mentioned that Kathryn Bigelow was not nominated. Well, they've dug themselves a little hole at the Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Sciences. If you allow up to 10 Best Pictures, there's still only 5 director slots. So how are you going to, you know— square all that.
Now, just before we move on from this film, and for those of us who find torture scenes a little bit hard to watch, just how tough is it, and can Steve Kraske get through it?
Well, I think you will get through it, because I never felt that it was ever exploitative. I mean, if ever there was an instance where this sort of behavior was cinematically presented with a purpose, here it is. And you know what? Some of the worst stuff in this isn't physical torture at all. It's the mental. It's the way people get into other people's heads. And there's a young CIA analyst who's doing the interrogations. And here's the thing. He's a nice guy. He's played by a young actor named Jason Clark. When he's not in there being this good cop, bad cop, he's a swell fella. And interestingly enough, halfway through the movie, he has to go back to the States because he can't take what he's doing anymore.
Bob Butler's review of this film is just out on butlercinemascene.com. And, Bob, you gave this movie what grade?
I believe it was an A-. It's okay. Pretty good stuff.
Pretty good stuff. Okay. Let's move on to another film opening, The House I Live In. It's a documentary about U.S. drug policy and the criminal justice system, Bob.
Well, you know, this is a film by a documentarian named Eugene Jarecki. His brother, Andrew, is also a well-known who did the Capturing the Freedmans a few years ago. He spent the last 5 years trying to do the ultimate film about the war on drugs. Now, I admit, I think he went into it with a prejudice that is it a prejudice to say the war on drugs isn't working? Because they're everywhere.
Yeah.
I guess the question—
a lot of people agree with that sentiment, yeah.
I guess the question is, have we totally put all our resources in the wrong place? And his theory is basically that what we've done is the war on drugs isn't so much a war on drugs anymore. It's a war on minority people without jobs, people who only have drugs to get them through the day. And that's why America has more, a higher percentage of its population behind bars than any other industrialized country. Mm. It's just kind of, and most of those, of course, are minorities. There's a great clip coming up here. David Simon, he was a reporter for the Baltimore Sun. He covered the war on drugs, and then he went on to write the HBO series The Wire, which was, you know, over five seasons, talked about the drug war in one city. And he's the main voice you're going to hear here. He's sort of the spokesman, the talking head that the movie keeps coming back to.
This film, The House I Live In.
I don't think people fully understand. In the inner city, these kids are making rational choices. I profiled a girl who was like this, a 10-year-old girl. The minute she steps out her front doorway, there are drug dealers out there, no economic opportunity. The school is warehousing her. She doesn't see any prospects. How is she supposed to get out?
At the end of the day, when there's not a lot of resources out here and your teachers aren't stressing you to come to class or not even caring, you know, you're not going to go to school. You're going to sell drugs. You're going to do what you have to do.
To go down to a drug corner in the inner city is the rational act of somebody going to work for the only company that exists in a company town. When that is the only economy that's functioning in certain places in this country, what do we expect?
Profound stuff. It's deep. It's disturbing. You know, one thing I learned here that I didn't know. Richard Nixon, of course, started the war on drugs. He first coined the phrase, but his whole plan was that the vast majority of the money should be spent on treatment.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Did not know that.
The guy a pat on the back for that, because it didn't work out that way.
You know, the story that haunts me from my career, you know, going back, 15 years in Topeka one morning, a guy went into the federal courthouse, went to the top floor, came off the elevator and began shooting, and went into the clerk's office and did more mayhem and then shot himself. People hid in the ceilings of the courthouse for hours. You know, one of those classic scenes where we've become so familiar with over the years. And he was upset because he had just been busted for growing marijuana on a farm just north and east of Topeka. And you look at that mayhem and that carnage in the wake of that, you look back on it now and you just, questions do go through your mind.
Well, this is almost only about the victims of the war on crime. Or the war on drugs. It doesn't really address one of the major issues, which is that it has created a criminal underworld that is vicious and violent and wealthy as it can possibly be. And it's exactly like Prohibition.
You gave this film, The House I Live In, what grade?
I gave it a B because although I love the information, I don't think it was it's a little off. It's a little, how shall I call it, kitchen sink.
Preachy?
Not preachy. It just throws a lot of stuff. And there's so much information in it that it doesn't flow, you know. Sometimes it's a little trial to get through it.
Sort of like Lincoln.
Okay, then,
okay,
yeah.
That's
yeah.
What you hear. Yeah. If you're just joining us this morning, you're listening to Up to Date on KCUR. We're talking about the latest indie foreign and documentary films now showing. We're visiting with Bob Butler, who works at the Kansas City Public Library. He's our one remaining standing critic today. Steve Walker out sick. Cynthia Haynes out in Los Angeles. She joined us during our first half hour today. Let's move on to Brooklyn Castle, a documentary about members of a junior high school champion chess team.
Yeah, this is a film that kind of falls in the inspirational young kid category. Remember Mad Hot Ballroom? Remember Spellbound? They were both movies about young people involved in competitions and how the study of whatever it is they're studying elevates them. Well, there is a middle school in New York City in Brooklyn that has, for 20 years, has had the world's greatest middle school chess team. And this is about the kids in the team. It's about the administrators and teachers that make it happen. It's about how the nerds rule this place. It's also about the New York City, the hit the schools took after the financial breakdown when programs like their chess club were threatened. What we've got here is a really nice clip. A young girl named Rochelle, she is poised to become the first African-American female grandmaster. She's only like 14 years old.
Mm.
But she's left the middle school, gone to high school, and she is now finding that there are too many things competing for her attention. I mean, she wants to hang with her friends. She has to study. Who wants to spend all that time studying old chess games? And she talks to one of her former classmates' mothers, and this is what the conversation, how it ensues.
This is from Brooklyn Castle.
You have to do it, sir. Because you have to look at it in those terms.
Yeah, I'm doing it, but with my mom, it's school comes first, so I can't.
School comes first, but yeah. Is becoming, you know, the first African American female master really that important to me? Because if it's not, then that's a different thing.
You know, if you don't really want that goal, that's fine. Then say that. And then that way, no one's going to really expect anything really too much great. But if you are saying that you really want it, and if you really do want it, then you have to do that work. At least show that passion. Show the same passion you had when you were rated 1600. Like, you have passion then, because you want it to really go up.
It's a nice movie. My main concern is that it felt awfully familiar to me because, you know, it falls into a pattern.
Other films just like it.
Yeah. Other films just like it. Then there's also the problem that with a spelling bee, you can kind of like participate in the spelling bee, but I cannot participate in a chess game. I don't know the moves. It's all too cerebral for me.
But what an interesting premise for the film, though. Again, based on obviously a real life story.
Yeah, it is. And if you're looking for something inspirational, there you go.
There you go. That film again, Brooklyn Castle. It opens at the Tivoli.
Today, I believe.
Okay, sounds good. Let's move on to The Impossible, based on a true story of a family separated following that big tsunami in Thailand.
Well, now you can pick on this if you want to nitpick. This is about a British family trapped by the tsunami. Now, obviously, a lot of people who live in Thailand full time had a terrible time during the tsunami. So yes, it does choose protagonists with whom American audiences are most likely to identify. You've got Ewan McGregor and Oscar-nominated Naomi Watts as the mother and father. In real life, this was a Spanish couple, but there again, a change has been made to appeal to us Yanks. They're vacationing over Christmas. The tsunami hits. The family is separated. This is a grueling, really staggeringly scary, in a way, movie about people surviving. If you can imagine, you know, a beautiful resort suddenly turned into a mud-covered wreckage. And the mother, played by Naomi Watts, almost dies from the injuries, but she and her son managed to somehow get to a hospital.
Now, I've seen the preview for this film, which features, it looks like a man standing on the edge of a pool at the hotel.
Yes.
And behind him, coming up from behind him, he doesn't see it coming, is this incredible
wave wall of water,
that just
20 feet
washes
high.
Over.
Yeah, you see the first thing you see is the palm trees in the distance going down.
Yeah,
and then the wall of water hits. Now,
just a terrifying image, by the way.
What we got here is a clip. Ewan McGregor has been separated from one of his sons and from his wife. He borrows a cell phone from other survivors. His is completely lost, to make a call back to England to tell the family what has happened. So here we go.
Did you hear from anyone yet? Marie and Lucas are not here.
What do you mean, not there?
The water came and swept everyone away. And I found Thomas and Sam, but I don't know where Marie and Lucas are. I don't know what to do, I don't know where to look for them. Lots of people need to use this phone, okay? I was calling it. Thank you.
You can't leave it like that. Go on. Come on.
Yes,
Harry. Brian, it's me again. Look, I promise you that I won't stop looking until I find him, okay?
Okay.
I don't know what I'm going to do because it's night time now, but I'll look in all the hospitals and I'll look in all the shelters and everything, okay? And I will find them, I promise you that. I'll call you when I do.
Okay.
Okay.
My goodness.
Yay, Ewan McGregor. That's some acting.
Boy, that is some acting. Even over just listening to the audio, just amazing.
So not an easy movie, but I think it's one that will reward you if you've got the gumption to go through with it.
I think gumption's the key word there. That film, again, The Impossible, the story of the tsunami hitting Thailand. Okay, let's move on to Promised Land as we review the latest indie foreign and documentary films showing around town. Again, Promised Land, a gas company employee has second thoughts about the impact of fracking on Midwest farmers. This film stars Matt Damon.
Matt Damon, who is the new Jimmy Stewart. He's the kind of guy that can sell anything, and he's such a natural actor that you always buy it.
Yeah.
He plays a guy named Steve Butler who goes out and buys land from basically distressed farming communities so that they can frack. Now, we all know about frack and its reputation.
It's going on in South Central Kansas as we speak.
It is. And it's more, this could have been sort of like a pro-environmental screed. It isn't. It's a character study of a guy who has talked himself into believing. and
that this is okay to do.
Yeah, well, I think he does believe. And Matt Damon is such an affable guy, and the character he's playing is such a sweet fella that, you know, even people that are opposed to him can't help but like him. Now, the scene we've got is at a community meeting in a high school gym, and the local high school science teacher, played by Hal Holbrook, challenges this guy.
This is from Promised Land.
I'm sorry. I don't mean to interrupt you, Mr.
Yates. My name is Frank Yates.
Mr. Yates, are you with an environmental group?
No.
No. Well, what line of work are you in, sir?
I'm a teacher at the high school.
A teacher?
I teach science. What about you, Mr.?
Okay, yeah, well, I deserve that. Steve Butler is my name. I'm a consultant here with Global. I only caught the tail end of what you were saying, but you seem like someone who's done his homework. Could I ask you, though, where'd you get your information?
Mr. Butler, you and I both know the information I've been talking about is vast and detailed.
You're probably right. I'm not the guy with all the answers.
Oh, well, then you'd be the perfect guy for them to send here to deny everything.
I love Hal Holbrook. He sat in your chair once before a year or two ago, and his career just keeps on keeping on.
Yeah, I don't know. He's in his 80s now and
wonderful guy.
Chewing
wonderful
up the
man.
Screen. Yeah, well, this I like this movie a lot. It's low-keyed. It was directed by Gus Van Sant, solid, and written by Matt Damon and his co-star in this, John Krasinski. So I would
John Krasinski from The Office.
The Office. I would definitely give this one a try.
Oh, no kidding. Okay, again, that's Promised Land. Good review from Bob Butler there. How about Hyde Park on Hudson? And the trailers look so great. A month in the life of President Franklin D. Roosevelt, June of 1939. But critics have not been kind to this film, Bob.
I don't know what their beef is. I enjoyed it. Now, granted, Bill Murray playing FDR sounds like a bad Saturday Night Live skit.
Mm-hmm.
He plays it pretty straight. He's good at it. The movie, I think, it's lightweight, but I found it hugely enjoyable. And it follows basically two plots. First, you have Laura Linney as a distant cousin of FDR who is called in by the family to basically keep him occupied at the Hyde Park summer retreat. And lo and behold, he seduces her. Apparently, the president, despite his polio, still had a very active romantic life. Mm-hmm. Now, that's one of the plot lines. The other one has to do with the King of England, the same fellow who was featured in the King's Speech, coming over to try to get American support for the inevitable war against Germany. And we've got a scene here, a late night scene where the king, who is very nervous, very ill at ease, he was a stutterer, remember, has a drink in the study after everyone's gone to bed with the President of the United States.
You were wonderful tonight, young man. What do you mean? Just what I said. You were graceful. You were confident. You're going to be a very fine king.
I don't know what to say.
Your father would be very proud.
I'm not so certain about that.
If I were your father, I'd be proud.
You know, I really want to like this film. I want to go see it. I like Bill Murray. I love Laura Linney. And I'm glad to hear you say it's worth going to see.
I'm not going to tell you it's great, Jakes. I'm just going to say I found it very satisfying 2 hours.
Okay, that film again, Hyde Park on Hudson. Now let's move on to Any Day Now, set in the 1970s. A gay couple fight to keep custody of an abandoned, handicapped teenager.
All right, this is basically a vehicle for Alan Cummings, who is an openly out actor. He's incredibly talented, and he does everything in this movie but give birth, basically. I mean, he covers all of it. He plays a drag queen, so he gets to lip sync and dance. He turns to vocals and becomes a cabaret singer. So it's sort of like, you know, do you have any more skills we'd like to exploit here? The story itself, it has its moments, but I got to tell you, it's pretty sappy. What we have here is where he and his partner, played by Garrett Delahunt, and this is 1979 when gay people adopting children was just not done, giving their new quote-unquote son his first bedroom.
Okay, from Any Day Now.
We know you love your doll, but we got you all those other toys, too, that you could play with, the robots and the teddy bear and the pig.
This is my home.
Yeah. This is your home.
Oh, sweetheart.
You all right? You okay?
I'm so sorry.
Aw.
That's good.
From Any Day Now, and Bob Butler calls it a little sappy.
Kind of a tearjerker, but if you're an Alan Cumming fan, well, there you have it.
Let's just kiss, not fade away, the story of three New Jersey kids who are inspired to form a rock band.
Okay, David Chase, who created The Sopranos, directed and wrote this. It's a very fun movie about the 60s music scene and a bunch of kids that want to put together a band and never achieve stardom, but rock and roll transforms their lives. Very few films I have seen, because I grew up in this era, get everything right. The music, the looks, the cars, the clothes. This one nails it all because it's all basically an autobiography of this guy, David Chase, who wanted to be a rock and roller. He didn't want to make TV. Great stuff. Go for it.
What's coming up at the Kansas City Library? Anything you want to mention?
Yeah, this Sunday, 1:30 at the Plaza Library, My Darling Clementine, John Ford. I'll be introducing it with Henry Fonda as Wyatt Earp, one of the best Westerns ever made.
1:30 on Sunday.
Yep.
That's Bob Butler. You can find a list of the films we reviewed today, as well as our critics three to see at kcur.org. Bob, thanks for coming in today. Don't forget to follow KCUR on Facebook and this program on Twitter. We're at KCUR Up to Date, and you can follow me at Steve Kraske. Monday on the program, we'll look at the booming oil and gas industry in Kansas. Our show's theme music is by Bobby Watson and the UMKC Conservatory of Music Concert Jazz Band. We had help this week from KCUR's Kim Noble, Danny Alexander, and Beth Lipoff. Our senior producer is Steven Steigman. Have a great weekend, all. I'm Steve Kraske of the Kansas City Star, and you are up to date.